delivers books, but also a sense of community along Liverpool's South Shore.
Hang in there.
I'm a year older today.
Are you in this birthday?
Crystal Herbert.
Well, congratulations. What does that make you?
63.
No.
Yeah.
In New Brunswick, a local historian publishes a 1,000-page long book on the Canadian First World War cap badges.
My aim with this book is to connect people and their history with an artifact that they can hold and say, this was a piece of what my family was about.
In Cobourg, Ontario, the Night Stop program is looking for volunteers willing to share their homes with homeless youth. And one person can make a big difference in the lives of many others. Ole Dektyarov, Iron Man Run, is fueling a bigger fight for Ukraine.
Every time I wake up, I want to live. I'm like, man, I'm doing something for my country. I'm doing something for my people. I wake up with a purpose, because at the end of the day, like, when the war is over, you want to say, hey, I did something. Like, when people ask, what did you do? I did this.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello to you all. Nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Chassin, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. A mobile library has been operating on Liverpool's South Shore since the 1970s, and it's the last one of its kind in Nova Scotia, still motoring through the region each week. The Bookmobile brings books, DVDs, and other materials to about 15 communities in Lunenburg and Queens counties, from Chester to Caledonia. And it keeps rolling even as other library systems around Nova Scotia have stopped their service. The Cape Breton Regional Library retired its Bookmobile in November 2024. So now the South Shore has the only remaining Bookmobile in the province, and it shows no signs of slowing down. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Hello.
Good day.
Hi.
Good day.
You're back.
3 weeks go by so fast.
Yeah,
day.
Right?
You beat the rest of them here.
It's the last one in Nova Scotia, and it's still motoring along the South Shore. Each week, the Bookmobile brings books, DVDs, and other materials to about 15 communities in Lunenburg and Queens counties, from Chester to Caledonia. A mobile library has been operating on the South Shore since the 70s. Other library systems around Nova Scotia have stopped the service. The Cape Breton Regional Library retired its Bookmobile in November 2024. So now, the South Shore has the only remaining Bookmobile in the province, and it shows no signs of slowing down. Ashley Nunn-Smith is the CEO and Chief Librarian of South Shore Public Libraries.
Our Bookmobile has been on the road for 50 years, of course different vehicles throughout that time, but it's much beloved. It's very much a fabric of the community. When it is off the road, for example, a few weeks ago, we had someone bring the books out to Caledonia in their van because the Bookmobile was having some mechanical issues. And not only did people come to pick up their items, but they actually had almost like a tailgate party. They just hung around the back of the van and chatted with their neighbors. There was nothing keeping them there other than that sense of community. And so I think that's really what it's not just about the books, although that's wonderful to be able to drive books out to people when they live in more remote communities. It's really about the sense of community.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right.
Yeah. Hang in there.
I'm a year older today.
Is this your birthday?
Crystal Herbert.
Well, congratulations. What does that make you?
63.
No.
Yeah.
That can't be.
Joan Stevenson of Port Jolly was at a recent Bookmobile stop in Port Mattoon. Stevenson and her daughter Susie are some of the regular patrons the Bookmobile serves every 3 weeks at this location. It visits certain communities on a weekly basis, while others are on a tri-weekly schedule.
We remember when we had to fight to get a Bookmobile because the county didn't want it, although they were paying towards one, but they didn't want it. And instead they put street lights on our road and fought the Bookmobile. And we said it's a different kind of enlightenment.
Happy birthday.
I do it today.
Happy.
How old are you, Terry?
63, just a boy.
In 2021, the library put a new custom-built bookmobile on the road at a cost of about $500,000 with an accessibility lift, Wi-Fi, and 7 electrical outlets where people can charge their devices. Last year, the mobile service had an average of 1,100 monthly visitors who checked out about 3,000 items, accounting for about 15% of the library's overall visits and circulation. The cost of the bookmobile takes up about 2% of the library's overall $1.9 million operating budget. Nunn Smith says that because the South Shore has fewer physical library locations than other library systems around Nova Scotia, having the bookmobile is essential.
That by having the library on wheels, we can bring it to more spaces than we would be able to reach with brick and mortar locations. We're able to reach more communities that we wouldn't be able to otherwise. We reach Port Mattoon and we Mill Village and those places, it wouldn't be feasible to operate a library branch. And so we're able to bring the library to them.
Susie Stevenson says she remembers the anticipation as a kid waiting for the bookmobile to visit, a feeling she still has years later.
We all went and we'd come home with clothes baskets full of books, and the 8 of us would just sit around and read. And that's, you would get the books and you'd sit around and read, and you would do it until they were like, until you had to eat. Keeps me in reading material, and it keeps me, you know, interested and not depressed. That I can sit, I can read a book, I can look at it, and whether I read them or all or look at them, I'll take 2 or 3 bags lots of times.
Her mother Joan says it's something she looks forward to every 3 weeks.
I can't be away too long. My husband's disabled. So it's fun to come here. And the wonderful thing is that the people who drive and work on the bookmobile over all these years we've had it have always become our friends. They know what we're looking for, and we laugh, and they want to know how your trip was or how somebody's had a surgery was. It's they become friends. Nay, we love it. We love the bookmobile. I'm an old lady, and hopefully it will outlive me.
Yes, we'll look forward to doing it 3 weeks from today. Awesome. Thank you. See you, girls, ladies.
We'll say happy birthday.
Yes, thank you. We're going to get together.
You can find the schedule for the bookmobile on the South Shore Public Library's website.
I got your beer cold.
Oh, right on.
I know.
That's an invite. I'll bring my cold beer.
All right. You bring your cold beer.
All right. See ya.
See ya.
I'm Rick Conrad.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
We'll make our next stop in Winnipeg, running alongside Oleh Dekcharov, who's going to do a full Ironman triathlon to raise funds for Ukraine. Oleh Dekcharov is now training for the event 6 days a week, often waking up at 5 a.m., this to raise $100,000 for the armed forces of Ukraine. Through his initiative, Iron Hearts for Ukraine, athletes can register as ambassadors working towards their goals while raising funds together. Dekcharov says the past few months have been difficult to witness. He recalls watching the news when President Zelensky came to see Trump in the Oval Office and how upsetting the conversation was. Despite support from the U.S. hanging by a thread, Dekcharov says he is not deterred. In fact, he's more motivated than ever. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Muscles aching and lungs burning, Oleh Dekcharov pushes himself through his workouts. He does this 6 days a week, often waking up at 5 a.m. to train.
Every time I wake up and I know that I'm doing this with my team, I want to live. I'm like, man, I'm doing something for my country. I'm doing something for my people. I wake up with a purpose.
Oleh's goal is to complete a full Ironman triathlon. But more importantly for him, to raise $100,000 for the armed forces of Ukraine.
Because at the end of the day, like when the war is over, you want to say, hey, I did something. Like when people ask, what did you do? I did this. And I did this because we had this great idea and we pulled it off.
With family moving to Canada 14 years ago and himself moving to Canada 8 years ago, Ole has spent the past few years actively supporting his home country. Now he'll do that through a new initiative, Iron Hearts for Ukraine.
Kind of last year, I was competing in triathlon. So I got into triathlon. My dream was to complete a full Ironman. So it's a 4K swim, 180K bike, and a full marathon to run. And last year, I completed half Ironman, which was fun. And right after that, I was like, well, why don't I just start raising money for Ukrainian Armed Forces as I'm training for the full Ironman for next year?
Ole says the past few months have been difficult to witness, with the United States pulling support for Ukraine feeling like a betrayal. He recalls watching the news when President Zelensky came to see Trump in the Oval Office.
That whole scene that unfolded there, right? It was painful to watch because, like, there's a guy coming and asking for help. And I don't want to say bullying, but there's, like, a lot of disrespect to him.
He continues.
Their support was, like, probably 60-70% of the whole packages of support, right? That's big. That's big. And the fact that they're trying to push now is Zelensky to kind of settle for it's not supposed to be a discussion.
Despite support from the U.S. hanging by a thread, Ole says he is not deterred. In fact, he says he's more motivated than ever. However, raising $100,000 is difficult to do alone. So Ole and his team created Iron Hearts for Ukraine,
where we can kind of bring athletes around Canada together, Ukrainians, Canadians, anybody who is interested to support Ukraine. We're going to give them the opportunity to raise money, train for their events. We're going to bring the community together. We're going to create some maybe group chats on WhatsApp, motivate people. It's going to be great. So let's do that.
When asked why he set the goal at $100,000, Ole laughs.
It's a challenge. $100,000 sounds big, but at the end of the day, my family has friends that serve. And when you ask them how much money, like, does it go every single day? Like those drones that people donate their money on, like $2,000, it's up in the air, 2 seconds later, it's gone. So $2,000 goes to waste within like 10 minutes, just so I understand. So like having collected $100,000, in reality, it's not really a big amount, but for us, it sounds like a challenge.
The Iron Hearts for Ukraine initiative is already gaining traction. Ole's mother is training for a marathon, and several close friends have signed up as ambassadors. He says most ambassadors are Ukrainian or of Ukrainian descent, and understands that the ongoing conflict feels distant for many Canadians. However, he believes that might change with the continued threats of making Canada the 51st state.
Possibly, I think so, especially with the everything that Trump is saying right now. You know, it's for Canada, it's threats pretty much, right? But everything he does towards Europe and towards Ukraine right now, I really hope it's going to stimulate people to be like, hey, I got to take action. Like, I got to do something myself.
Ole says he is confident they'll reach their goal and maybe even exceed it. However, he says, most of all, he hopes that people are inspired to make a difference, whether it's through his initiative or another.
The more people support initiatives like that, the faster we're going to raise the money and the more help we're going to get. And, you know, as one of our teammates on this team is saying, it's like, you know, I really hope we're going to save at least one life. If we're going to save at least one life, that's great.
Okay.
That's what it's all about, yeah?
I'm Ryan Funk.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
To the province of Quebec now, where the Legault government is creating quite a stir with a new bill banning religious symbols. He wants to expand the ban further into the education system. If adopted, as most analysts say it will, Bill 94 could prevent every employee and volunteer involved in the education system from wearing religious symbols. Under the current rules set by Bill 21, teachers and public-facing civic employees cannot wear religious symbols. Adam Innes spoke with the legal expert Pearl Eliadis and board member of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women, Shaheen Ashraf, about Quebec's secularism trends. Adam Innes in Montreal, Quebec.
Under the current rules set by Bill 21, teachers and public-facing civic employees cannot wear religious symbols such as turbans, hijabs, kippahs, or other religious symbols. This new bill, tabled earlier in March, Bill 94, which is expected to pass, will extend that ban beyond just public-facing employees. Janitors, school administrators, and even volunteers would not be able to work in religious symbols. Students would also not be able to wear face coverings. Pearl Eliadis is a legal scholar and practicing lawyer who specializes in democratic governance. Eliadis says this is part of Quebec's trend towards a more intrusive definition of secularism.
Quebec has an ever-diverging view of what secularism means that increasingly is moving away from the standards that have been set by the Supreme Court of Canada and by human rights legislation in Canada.
Eliadis believes this new expansion is dragging the discussion around secularism in an unreasonable direction.
Public-facing officials who wield authority over people, I think reasonable people can differ about whether or not it's appropriate to restrict their religious rights because they're facing the public. People might be concerned, for example, of a policeman or policewoman, you know, with a certain a religious symbol. I personally don't share that view, but at least I understand it. I don't think it's right, but I understand it. But this change, you know, I think shows that the divergence is moving even further away, because now we're talking about people who aren't even necessarily public facing.
Shaheen Ashraf is a board member of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women, a group that has been advocating for the rights of Muslim women in Canada since 1982.
We actually advocate, you know, for the Muslim woman's right to wear whatever she is comfortable in.
Ashraf believes these rules are designed to aggravate Muslims in the province. The banning of symbols for volunteers, she finds especially extreme.
It's terrible. It's terrible. I mean, I have contributed to society by the grace of God in a good way all the time, and I cover my head, and nobody has a problem with that, you know? Except the government just creating rules for nothing. I mean, they create problems for things that don't exist or matter. Yeah. I mean, define secularism to me. What is secularism according to your belief? To me, today in Quebec, the secularism is like another religion that is being forced down our throats.
The province would not respond directly to Eliadis's and Ashraf's comments, but pointed CJLO to a media statement from Quebec Education Minister Bernard Drenville, who wrote, quote, "In Quebec, we made the decision that state and religion are separate. We say the public schools are separate from religion," unquote. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
In Ontario, the Rebound Child and Youth Services are seeking to decrease youth homelessness in Northumberland County by asking for volunteers who are willing to share their home for a night. The new program called Night Stop will begin next month. Night Stop was first started in the United Kingdom in the 1980s. Night Stop will be looking for community volunteers willing to offer a room in their home for the youth to spend the night. An extensive vetting process of both the youth and the homeowner ensures that all involved are provided with safe and supportive opportunities. Dan Jones in Cobourg, Ontario.
A new youth homelessness program is being launched in Northumberland County. Night Stop, which is set to begin in May, aims to place youth aged 16 to 24 in vetted homes in the community, either for a single night or an extended stay. A host home is generally a volunteer community member who has undergone extensive training, ensuring youth accessing their home are provided safe and supportive housing. Rebound Child and Youth Services is offering the program. Executive Director Sam Rockbrun told a Northumberland County Social Services Committee meeting Wednesday that Night Stop is designed to provide temporary housing.
Night Stop is an alternative housing solution for youth experiencing homelessness by enlisting community members to volunteer their homes as temporary shelters for youth in need. Currently, Northumberland County does not have a youth shelter, which makes Night Stop the first resource for youth in crisis in the community, and it's essential for addressing this critical gap for youth homelessness.
The program was founded in the United Kingdom in 1987, eventually taking roots in Canada in 2018. As part of the process, Rebound will conduct risk assessments on the youth, including two reference checks. The host home will offer a private room to sleep, an evening and breakfast meal, and a to-go lunch. Shower and laundry facilities are also accessible. Nightstop staff will ensure a smooth transfer for the youth at night and be available for the duration of the stay. Youth must abstain from substance use and follow host rules. Rockburn says finding stable housing for youth is the ultimate goal.
Nightstop really is a way to fill a gap, so that way youth are not sleeping rough on the streets or are not sleeping somewhere unsafe. In terms of some alternative options, it's kind of a unique case by case. Quite often it is family reunification or natural supports. So maybe you are able to put them, again, in with an aunt or an uncle that they weren't previously living with, especially if they're able to get onto the trusteeship program at the same time.
Youth can access Nightstop for up to 6 weeks. I'm Dan Jones.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
We close our show in Fredericton this week, where local historian and former president of the York Sunbury Historical Society, Harold Hal Scarrop, began distributing his latest book. Harold chose a long title for his 1,000-page long book, Canadian Expeditionary Force and Military Cap Badges, York Sunbury Historical Society, Fredericton Region Museum Collection. Mr. Scarrop was on a mission to catalog every badge worn by the Canadian military on their hats during the First World War, the majority of which were photographed from the Fredericton Region Museum's collection. Scarrop hopes that his book will serve as a resource for museums, archives, and enthusiasts to better understand and connect with the past. Journalist Aidan Keenan in Fredericton met up with Hal Scarrop to talk about the significance of cap badges and why he thought it was so important to create this book.
In March of 2025, Fredericton-based historian Hal Scarrop began distributing his newest book, called Canadian Expeditionary Force and Militia Cap Badges, York Sunbury Historical Society, Fredericton Region Museum Collection. Coming in at a little over 1,000 pages, this book catalogs all the cap badges used by the Canadian military during the First World War. Each entry is accompanied by a color photograph of the badge itself, almost all of which are held in the Fredericton Region Museum's collection. Being admittedly a niche topic, Hal explained who his intended audience is.
These are reference material books. My hope is that the museums will make use of these books, and this one specifically on the badges. It's one of two. I mean, it was such a big project, just the First World War. And it's 1,000 pages that I had to break it up into First War and Second World War. If you were at a museum in Manitoba or Nova Scotia or Newfoundland or wherever, and you're looking up First World War badges, this book, A, has a photograph of the cap badge. Two, if you want to know something about the unit's history, I've gone into the Library and Archives Canada files for the official war records, and I've taken their 2 to 3 paragraph summary of the history of that unit. When it was formed, where it was formed, how it was formed, and sent overseas. Was it disbanded or did it fight? Who was famous? Who won the Victoria Cross, for example? And then it's indexed so that a researcher from anywhere can find it.
Hal elaborated on what makes cap badges specifically so significant.
If you get into the world of badge collecting, you have to realize that that's only part of your uniform. Even today, you wear a cap badge. On your shoulder, you wear a flash that tells you which unit you're with. The badges change with the kings and the queens. For example, we've just gone from the queen's crown for Queen Elizabeth to the king's crown for King Charles III. New badges are required to carry that out. My thought was that other collectors have put together all of the minutiae, the collar dogs and the shoulder flashes. You're getting down into the weeds there and serious money and serious difficulties cataloging everything. But the badge is extremely important to the person wearing it. A lot of people during the Second World War, when they're brought in, were loaned to a unit. Okay, I don't have a vacancy for you at the moment, but if you want to get fed, I got to attach you to the South Saskatchewan Regiment. I know you're from New Brunswick, and we'll get you with the New Brunswick unit. But you're with the SSRs for the next 3 days, so you get fed and paid. Okay, now we're officially assigning you to the Cape Breton Highlanders. So people actually have backgrounds where they might have worn several different badges, but the one that's most important to them is the one that they served with the most.
Beyond simple military identification, Hal noted that there's often a deep sentiment attached to physical pieces of history like cap badges, especially after those who wore them are no longer with us.
When my grandfather passed, my aunt, she said, I think you'd like to have these. And she gave me my grandfather's spurs from 1915. And I hold these things today and I said, this was my grandfather's. He was there. This is the real McCoy. This isn't something I got from somebody else at a flea market. This was his. And it bites. It hits. And if it has that effect on me, I suspect that other people, when they take a cap badge that would have been worn by their family member in 1917, it's going to have the same effect.
Hal emphasized that connecting people to that history was his ultimate goal when writing this book.
What can we put together that will be useful to a person who comes in off the street and says, my grandfather says that I read that he served in the 126th Battalion. Do you have anything that belonged to him? You can go to this book and you look up the name of the battalion in the index. The index will take you to page 93, and here's a photograph of that badge. Now, the person working in the museum today opens the book to the page on the badge and looks down, and it has the accession number. You take this individual, and you go upstairs, and you open that drawer, and here is the real badge, one like your grandfather might have worn in the First World War, and you put it in that person's hand, and suddenly it's not a picture in a book. It's the real artifact. So it's my aim with this book is to connect people and their history with an artifact that they can hold and say, this was a piece of what my family was about. That's the aim of the book.
Hal finished by describing some of the more interesting badges he came across while writing.
There are badges dedicated to the Viking community of Canada. And so, of course, the badge has the Viking ship with a Norseman. There are peculiar badges that are a devil with a pitchfork. About 7 or 8 different ones. Why? I don't know. The little red devils, whatever it is. There are badges, one from British Columbia, with 2 lions on it. And how did that come about? There are badges that have very little more than the number on them, which is kind of odd. And then there are some that are so darn elaborate, it's really difficult to figure out. We also have badges that soldiers traded to other countries. So we have badges from New Zealand and Australia, for example. There are badges from way back in the day that would surprise you by the names of them. A very large number of Acadian badges that have traditions that go back from before the British occupation here. And in fact, the museum has a number of badges that no one else has. And when I was going to other collectors asking for photographs of a few that we don't have, they came back and said, do you have a picture of the 187th? And I said, yes, because we have one. He said, nobody else has got one.
I'm Aidan Keenan, Local Journalism Initiative.
And that's it for us. A big thank you to our journalists this week, Rick Conrad, Adam Innes, Ryan Funk, Dan Jones, and Aidan Keenan. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Desine. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Radio@frequencynews.ca.
TJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.